Well, we can talk about glory coming down all night. Whoop. We just went through the whole Pentecost season, and glory coming down to empower us in our ministries and to preach the truth and to fix a world, to even churches that have gone so far off the rails that sometimes the gospel is not even recognizable anymore. But that's not what we're going to talk about tonight. we're going to say we're going to put together a PowerPoint about the trip, and we'll show it some other time, but we've been too out of it, jet-lagged, to do it the last couple of days. But I do want to talk about the people and the land. So we're going to show some scriptures. We're going to do a little bit of teaching, but it's going to be a little different than usual. But I just want to say, first of all, that thanks to the generosity of people here, we were able to really sow a lot of money into the places that we went, into congregations that we visited, and congregations that I preached at, and pastors and staff that we had meetings with, and we even gave money toward a place that needed a bathroom, because nothing in the toilets didn't work. They didn't have good, I mean, I don't know all the details of it, but there was a small congregation of Jewish believers that were like pleading for help to build a bathroom. So, you know, it's those kind of simple things that we take for granted here. We think, oh, bathroom, we'll just build one. And kind of reminded, you know, some of the areas there are really poor. A lot of this stuff reminded us of our Mexico trips, where we used to go into these horrible areas and people would say, well, none of the toilets flush. Say, oh, yeah, yeah. So we kind of got used to that, you know, and you'd go outside or you'd dump a bucket of water in the thing and flush it. But even in a developed country like Israel, there's a lot of pockets of poverty. And there's people there that are preaching the gospel. There's people there that are giving. I was telling Rodney earlier, people that are giving clothes and giving food and telling people to come. And they tell them about Jesus, tell them about Yeshua while they're getting some of their physical needs met, which is kind of a powerful way to evangelize. And we used to do that in Mexico City where, you know, people would say, man, we don't have any shoes, we don't have any socks, we don't have any. You'd say, well, here's some shoes, here's some socks, here's some shirts, and let me tell you about Jesus. Or in their case, Jesus. But same idea. So we were able to really help out. I know we'd have to make a list of everything, but, you know, giving money here and there and doing what we can. And in most of the congregations, we were not allowed to take pictures because there's so much fear. I don't even want to call it discrimination, but people are afraid that their coworkers, their family members, their neighbors are going to see that they're believers, then they're going to get discriminated against. So most of the places we went, we weren't allowed to take pictures, which was kind of a bummer. But we did get some pictures at some places, so we'll get those up for you in a PowerPoint. But if you sat through the other PowerPoints, they're all pretty much the same. But there's always such an intense feeling there. You know, it's, and I don't know how many of you have been to the Holy Land, but when you get to, thing that always strikes me is when you approach the Western Wall and you have to go through this security thing, so you have to go through a metal detector, there's a sign that says, you're approaching the holiest site in Judaism, and the presence of the Lord is always here. So that's really cool. But in the whole country, you feel that the presence of the Lord is always there. Because it is always there. He is always there. So whether you're in Jerusalem at the Western Wall, or you're looking up at where the temple was, or you're following the you know, the ways of the way of the cross, and you're seeing the tomb and the, you know, very powerful. But then when you go out into the Galilee, it's powerful in a different way. You think about Jesus being out on the water, standing at the shore, walking along the shoreline, you know, talking to whoever's coming by, walking around with that sorry bunch of disciples that he had, who just were common working people that were fishermen. And, you know, they were strong, and they probably had big, strong hands, and they probably weren't very educated, but here they were. And when you talk about those simple people, and, you know, I always use Peter as an example. And if somebody would have gone up to Simon, the, you know, a few days or a year before he met Jesus, and said, you know, you're going to meet the Messiah, and you're going to be one of his inner group of people, and then in a few years, you're going to be preaching all through the Middle East and all through the Mediterranean area, and you're going to end up in Rome, and you're going to be preaching there, and then they're going to kill you. He would have looked at you like you were from Mars. I'm just a fisherman over here. You know, Rome is the capital of the world. I can't go anywhere. I fish here. I got my own little fishing business here. But people's lives are radically changed. And, you know, the call to discipleship is a radical one. There's a lot of churches now that will tell you, oh, you know, that discipleship stuff, that's old-fashioned. Don't worry about it. Come to church, have some fun. We got a great music team. We want everybody to be happy. We don't want to offend anybody. So let's just have some fun. And then after church, we're going to go out to brunch. And then we're going to go home and take a nap. And this is Christianity in America now. But you know, in Mark chapter 8, Jesus says, if you want to follow me, you got to deny yourself. Because it's not about you. I love you and you're part of the kingdom. And because of the love that I have for you, you're in the kingdom. But it's not about your wants and your needs and your comfort. And it's not about whether you have a runny nose or a sore toe or it's raining outside. The issue is, if you're going to follow me, you got to deny yourself. And I recorded a couple of radio shows this morning, and what really struck me was when Jesus would have said to those guys, you got to take up your cross and follow me. Like, we've heard that 100 times, and we know about that, and we say, yeah, you know. But can you imagine saying to those guys who were under the oppression of Rome, you got to take up your cross and follow me? They knew what crosses were. They saw criminals executed on crosses all the time. And they saw this horrible instrument of torture set up with some poor guy roped to it or nailed to it, struggling to breathe, and then finally dying, sometimes after a day or two, with a big thing on top of it that said, here's the crimes this guy committed. So when he said to them, you got to take up your cross and you got to follow me, that would have sent shivers down their spine. They knew about crosses. We don't know about crosses. I mean, we know about crosses, but not like they did. You know, we could talk about, you know, the electric chair, the gas chamber, the lethal injection, but this was a horrible execution. So he says, basically, like Paul repeats years later, your old self has to be crucified so that your new self can follow him. And it's a radical thing. You know, Paul always talks about you live in the flesh or you live in the spirit. You know, your flesh wants to eat, go to sleep, be comfortable, not be in pain, enjoy yourself. You got lust and greed and all this stuff. That's all in your flesh. And you, so the flesh wants to be satisfied. You can't satisfy the flesh and the spirit all the time. So what struck me when I was thinking about the thing with the take up your cross, when these guys saw some criminal who was going to be executed walking down a road, and it was always done in public, he'd have been walking down Ridge Road with a handful of soldiers around him, carrying the whole cross, or at least the cross beam they usually carry. They knew where that guy was going, and they knew what was going to happen to him. And one thing they knew is he wasn't going to be coming back down Ridge Road. They were going to never going to see this guy again. So Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. You notice they don't answer anything when he says that. They can't even comprehend what he's talking about. So now we have a kind of Christianity where, hey, none of that matters. God wants us to be rich and healthy, and it's all about us. And Sunday morning is just kind of part of the entertainment. That's where we live now. That's where we live now. But when you go to this land, and it's simply called the land, Haaretz, the land, you feel that presence everywhere you go. And as we've talked about before, when the people are in the land is thriving. When the people are out of the land is desolate. Now the land is thriving. They're one of the world-leading exporters of oranges, and the place is a desert. So we're going to go back to the beginning, because in Genesis, what's the Hebrew name for Genesis? Bereshit. Back in the book of Genesis, God makes a promise to the patriarchs about this land. He doesn't say the land's going to be in Colorado, or he doesn't say it's going to be in Sweden, or he doesn't say it's going to be in East Africa, or he doesn't say it's going to be right outside of Las Vegas. Come on, let's get with the jokes now. He says, no, this is a specific land where he gets Abram, and you all know the story. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about this. But in Genesis 12, now the Lord, all capital letters, remember that's God's name, that's Yahweh. Now the Lord said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Two things. In verse 1, the Hebrew there means get up and go. This whole part of the Torah that's read on a certain Saturday morning is called Lech Lecha, which means get up and go. He doesn't tell Abram, man, you know, think about this. Let me just pose something to you. I got this land I want to take you to, and I know you're settled here, and you got a lot of money, and you got a lot of goats, and everything's good here for you, but I really want you to come to this other land, but, you know, think about it for a while. Take 3-4 weeks to think about it. And then if you decide to go, let me know. Then you can, you know, go to the post office and forward your mail, and you can discontinue your utilities and do all stuff. No, he says, get up and go. And Abram does it. You know, many times in the scripture it says Abram believed and it was counted as righteousness. Abraham, let's make it simple and call him Abraham, is following a voice. God somehow communicates with Abraham. We don't know if he sees something, but he definitely hears something. There's a deep communication. It's not like Moses who talks face to face with the Lord. Or it's not like the apostles that talked face to face with Jesus like we talk to each other. But there was a deep communication. And this old guy obeys. He's 75 years old at this time. He's no spring chicken. He's been on Social Security for 10 years already. And I forgot how old Sarah I was, but anyway, he's 75 years old. And so here's this old man in the middle of the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, and God says to him, I'm taking you someplace else. And all the families of the earth are going to be blessed through you. A 75-year-old guy who lives in what's currently Iraq. All the families of the earth are going to be blessed because of him. Wow, does that make any sense? If you're that guy, I mean, if you're a 75-year-old guy living in Parma, and you hear a voice that says, through you, all the communities, all the families on earth are going to be blessed, you say, that must have been something I ate. It kind of reminds me of, Monica knows who this guy is, so I'm not going to mention his name, but guy I was witnessing to for many, many years, and so one day we were having lunch, and I'm talking to him about the Lord, and I always slip into using the Christianese talk, like, oh, the Lord told me this, and the Lord told me that, and the Lord showed me this, and he's looking at me like, then finally he says, are you hearing voices? And I started laughing, thinking, man, this guy thinks I'm schizophrenic. But anyway, so all the earth is going to be blessed because of him, and he's going to get a certain piece of land. A certain piece of land. I don't know why God likes that land so much. There's more beautiful places in the world. There's certainly places with nicer temperatures. It was like 100 to 105 every single day we were there with that sun beating down on my bald head. But he loves this land. And right by the bed and breakfast place where we stay, there's this place called the Panorama. And Jewish tradition says that when Abram came from the land of the Chaldeans, he stopped at this point and looked down on what later would be Jerusalem and saw Mount Moriah for the first time. And of course, we don't know if that's true, but it was kind of a nice thought standing there looking at it, which is the Temple Mount. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. So this land was going to be given to his descendants. He calls himself a stranger in a strange land. You know, when Isaac, when he finally has Isaac, Yitzhak, which means laughter, because Sarah laughed when the angel said, I'll come next year and you'll have a baby boy. And then she tries to deny that she laughed, and the angel says, I saw you laughing. You know, Abraham didn't want Isaac to marry a woman from there. He wanted a woman from the homeland. So they went back to the land of the Chaldeans and got Rebekah for him. But this was the land they were going to inherit. And Isaac got the promise and Jacob got the promise. And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, lift your eyes now and look from the place where you are. Northward, southward, eastward, and westward. For all the land which you see, I give you and your descendants. For how long? Forever. Not for 20 years, not for a century or two, but forever. And on Mount Moriah, where the temple was, on the Temple Mount, and they just discovered this tremendous walkway that went from the city of David to the base of the Temple Mount that's 750 meters long, has the original pavement. And even the secular Israeli news people were so excited about this discovery that one of them just came right out and said, Jesus would have walked on this road. A secular Israeli news guy. They've dug up from the base of the Temple Mount, hundreds and hundreds of coins from the first temple period, from the Second Temple period, all the stuff. And the United Nations agrees that there was never a Jewish presence on the Temple Mount. This is the world where we live. And this goes along with the nonsense of, well, you might think I'm a man, but really I think I'm a woman, so therefore, I mean, this is the world that we live in. It's second half of Romans chapter 1. Every perversion comes from the fact that you worship the creature rather than the creator. That he gives us over to our reprobate mind and says, fine, you believe that, then go ahead, do what you want. And I also give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. Possession for how long? Everlasting. You know, a lot of people, a lot of churches used to preach replacement theology. Are you familiar with that? Because Israel did not accept the Messiah, the church becomes the new Israel. And so all the promises to Israel now belong to the church, and God is done with the Jews, done with Israel. But since most of those people don't ever read the scriptures, like the eternal promises to the patriarchs, we won't mention any churches by name, but actually most churches now don't read the scriptures. That's another different story. But in Jeremiah chapter 31, God says to Jeremiah, I don't have it up there, but you can look it up later for your homework. It starts about verse 35 or 36. God says, if you can control the sun and the moon, if you take the ordinances about the sun and the moon away from me and you control them, and if you can measure the heavens, and if you can measure the foundations of the earth, and if you can control the rain and the waves in the sea, when you can control that, then I'll give up on Israel. Which means never. Deuteronomy. Therefore, you shall keep every commandment which I command you today, that you may be strong and go in and possess the land which you cross over to possess, and that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to them and their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now, in ancient times, milk and honey meant the place was fertile, wealthy. You had all your needs met by the land. We think, like, who cares about milk and honey? But in those days, it was a big deal. Remember, agricultural society, subsistence kind of farming. So if you had a lot of milk, a lot of honey, you had it made. So remember, Deuteronomy is written just as they're about to cross over. It's 39 years since they left Egypt. Everybody over the age of 20 has died, except Joshua and Caleb. And Moses dies right around here. Everybody else who was over the age of 20 when they left Egypt has died now, because they were unfaithful and disobedient. But because the Lord swore to your fathers the land, you're going to the land. The time in Egypt was 425 years, more or less, depending how you count it. So that was an exile from the land. Exiled from the land 70 years when they went to Babylon. We talked about that forever a few weeks ago. Out of the land for almost 1900 years, from 70 AD to 1948. But now back in the land. For the land which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you sowed your seed, watered it by foot as a vegetable garden. But the land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water from the rain of heaven, a land for which the Lord your God cares. The eyes of the Lord your God are always on it, from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year. His eyes are always fixed on this land. Isaiah 49, God's talking to Isaiah about Jerusalem. He says, your walls are always before me. I always see your walls because this is my city. And it's part of all this beautiful thing, you know, can a woman forget her infant? Can a woman forget the child that she bore? Well, she might, but I'll never forget you. Because I have your names written on the palms of my hands. And your walls are always before me. Now see, as believers, we have that too. He's not going to forget us. He's not going to say, oh, wait a minute. Now who are you again? Oh yeah. He's got your name written on the palm of his hand. He's got your whole life in view. Just like he says to Jerusalem, your walls are always before me. He's got our whole lives in view. Because we're following Messiah. You know, it's a parallel. It doesn't mean we replace Jerusalem, but it's the same idea. Because we're following the true God. Interestingly, you know how we use the term somebody's the apple of your eye? If you really like something, you say they're the apple of my eye. You know, in Hebrew, the word for apple and the word for pupil of your eye are the same word. So when God says, I watch the apple of my eye, and nobody harms her, that means it's like part of his eye is like fixed on that land. We talked about this a few weeks ago, Zechariah 7. But I scattered them with a whirlwind among the nations which they had not known. Thus the land became desolate after them, so that no one passed through or returned, for they made the pleasant land desolate. So the people were exiled, the land became desolate. So when the people were in Babylon, you can read Lamentations. Jeremiah's walking around the city going, ugh, this used to be such a beautiful place and now look at it. You'd have gone out in the farmland and said, this used to be such a beautiful, productive farmland. Now look at it. From 70 AD till 1948, it was just desert. Very few things grew there. We're going to have some quotes later from non-biblical people. Names that you might recognize. Therefore say, thus says the Lord God, I will gather you from the peoples, assemble you from the countries where you have been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. So God's saying, even though I scattered my people all over the world, I'm going to gather them back to the land. Because Jesus can't come back until there's Israel. That's why most prophetic clocks, 1948 starts the countdown. Because now there's an Israel. If you read old commentaries, like I like commentaries that were written in the 1600s, 1700s, because they're so much more interesting than commentaries that were written in 2010. But all these commentators always mention, well, you know, there's no Israel, so we don't know. And at that point, it didn't seem like there was ever going to be an Israel again. Can you imagine going to the concentration camps during World War II? And telling all those people that were herded into the gas chambers, oh, in a few more years there's going to be Israel. It seemed pretty unlikely. Pretty unlikely. As a shepherd seeks out his flock on the day he is among his scattered sheep, so will I seek out my sheep and deliver them from all the places where they were scattered on a cloudy and dark day. I will bring them out from the peoples and gather them from the countries and will bring them to their own land. How cool is that? In our lifetime, we've seen this happen, more or less. I wasn't quite born in 48, but almost. But in our lifetime, we've seen this happen. And see, this is just, where do you hear this kind of language in the New Testament? Shepherd seeks out his flock, scattered sheep. I seek my sheep, I deliver him. John chapter 10. I know my sheep, they know me, they hear my voice. I go into the sheepfold and say, come on, let's go. I lead them out of the sheepfold. Jesus calls himself the good shepherd. He doesn't say, oh, I go into the sheepfold with my, I always forget what that thing's called, that hook they carry around, and say, come on, you guys, go. Starts hitting them with their stick. He said, no, I lead them out because my sheep hear my voice. So when you hear Jesus calling you, you follow the voice of the shepherd. So here, scattered Israel, God says, I'm the shepherd. I'm going to bring them back to the land. I'm going to guide them out from where they are. I will feed them on the mountains of Israel, in the valleys, and in all the inhabited places of the country. I will feed them in good pasture, and their fold shall be on the high mountains of Israel. Agriculture, livestock. Pre-1948, the place was a disaster, as we're going to see. Now there's stuff growing everywhere. A little dry while we were there. It was a little browner than usual. But the farm fields, the kibbutz fields, are all green. These are the people of the Lord, and yet they have gone out of his land. But I had concern for my holy name, which the house of Israel had profaned among the nations, wherever they went. We talked about this last time. Everywhere they were scattered, God says, the people there say, these are the people of the Lord, and they got kicked out of their land. God says, I don't want to hear that anymore. So for the glory of his name, he's going to regather them to the land. We may be persecuted for being Christians, but for the sake of his name, for the sake of the name of the Messiah, for the sake of the name of salvation, he's going to deliver us from persecution. For his name's sake. The desolate land shall be tilled instead of lying desolate in the sight of all who pass by. So they will say, this land that was desolate has become like the Garden of Eden. And the wasted, desolate, and ruined cities are now fortified and inhabited. The cities that are there now were little villages made out of mud and stones and some wood. There was no irrigation. There was not much around that was green. There were ruins from previous civilizations all over the place. Now they have real cities. And they have real farmland. And the mountains are given crops just like it was prophesied in Ezekiel. Ezekiel says the mountains are going to bring forth new wine. You know, new wine is always a sign of faith, of the Holy Spirit being poured out. You know, God's restoring the land because everything is getting ready for Jesus to come back. I hope it's tonight, but it's going to be soon. I hope it's maybe tomorrow. I love this one. But you, O mountains of Israel, you shall shoot forth your branches and yield your fruit to my people Israel, for they are about to come. Isn't that cool? God tells the land, my people are about to come back, so get ready. We're going to make some food. So God, in a sovereign way, picks this land. It says, this is the land where I'm going to put my name. This is the land that's going to produce the Messiah. This is the land where Messiah is going to be sacrificed. This is the land where sin's going to be atoned for. This is the land where my presence is going to be. And this is the land where I'm coming back to. And he picks sovereignly the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the prophets, and sends Messiah. And as we've talked about many times here, the point of picking Abraham to make a chosen people wasn't just, oh, it's nice we got a chosen people. Those people produced the Messiah's humanity. And this is what they're important for. Messiah Yeshua has real humanity. You know, it says in, Paul says in Galatians, he was born of a woman, born under the law. He didn't just appear. He was born, just like all of us were born. Right? Jesus, the second person of the Trinity, could have made a 30-year-old body for himself and lived in it and started his ministry when he was 30, could have gone to the cross to save us, and then could have risen from the dead, could have ascended to heaven, could have started off the Great Commission and everything else. No. He starts out like every other human being, as a single cell in a woman's womb, develops and then is born. And then it grows up. Has to learn how to talk, has to learn how to walk. They had to toilet train him. They had to tell him, we're going to go to the synagogue tomorrow, so you better be good. No, he was always good. Stop squirming. Can't you sit still? You can't go outside till you clean your room. No, he always had his room nice. But the humanity of Messiah came from these people that inherited this land. The covenant people lived in this land and are now back in this land again. 100 years ago, nobody would have conceived of this. In 1945, nobody would have conceived of this. The first people that went back were refugees from the Holocaust. Can you imagine? Just showing up there. And the day that the state was proclaimed, they were attacked from all sides by Arab armies. And they won. They didn't even have an army. In fact, there's this great, one of those DVDs, can't remember which one it is. There's like a reenactment of the Israeli cabinet meeting, and somebody says, well, you know, if we're going to have a war, we're going to need like some weapons. They didn't have anything. Now, Mark Twain, not in the scripture, but everybody knows Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, and Mark Twain was a pretty interesting writer. And in 1867, he went to the Holy Land. He went on a cruise that, I can't remember, it was like 6 months long and went to a whole bunch of places, but he spent several weeks in the Holy Land. We traversed some miles of desolate country where the soil is rich enough, but is given over wholly to weeds, a silent, mournful expanse wherein we saw only three persons, Arabs with nothing but a long, coarse shirt. So he travels for miles, and all he sees is weeds, and he sees three people this whole time. Desolation. Part of the ground we came over was not ground at all, but rocks. Gray lizards, those heirs of ruin, of sepulchers and desolation, glided in and out among the rocks, or lay still sunning themselves, where prosperity has reigned and fallen, where glory has flamed and gone out, where beauty has dwelt and passed away, where gladness was and sorrow is, where the pomp of life has been and the silence and death brood in its high places. So in other words, this was a beautiful land once. There was all kinds of stuff here, but now it's dead. It was once beautiful, now it's ugly. I mean, if you read the stuff he wrote about this is just snapshots. He said, I traveled for miles and didn't see a green thing. He said, everywhere I went, in any city, there were rats, it was dirty, and it smelled. He said, I don't know. I know this is the promised land, but I want to get out of here. Squalor and poverty are the pride of Tiberias. Tiberias is the third city. Squalor and poverty. Magdala is not a beautiful place. It is thoroughly Syrian, and that is to say, it is thoroughly ugly and cramped, squalid, uncomfortable, and filthy. If you saw the city now, you wouldn't believe it. It's this beautiful, picturesque city with brand new buildings, brand new houses on a sloping hill overlooking the Sea of Galilee. And when you're down on the main road and look up at it, it looks beautiful. But this is how he described it. Then Theodor Herzl, the father of Zionism, went there in 1897. Wanted to have a Jewish state. This was radical thinking in 1897. And he was a German. Radical thinking. So he got to Jerusalem. Soon the suffering, sorrow, and misery would also be reflected in Herzl's face as a result of what he saw in Jerusalem. Hideous, miserable, scrambling beggary, he reflected after returning from the Kotel, which is the Western Wall. 2 days after writing about magnificent Jerusalem, Herzl concluded in his diary, "If I remember thee in days to come, O Jerusalem, it will not be with delight." Remember the psalm where David says, "If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand lose its skill. May my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth." Herzl says, "When I remember you, I don't even want to think about you." 1897. So that was the situation, 1867, 1897. If they went there now, totally different. Agriculture, cities rebuilt, beautiful buildings, high-tech industry, which is booming, medical industry, which is booming. They even now have a They just announced a couple of weeks ago about they may have a cure for pancreatic cancer. Some other people announced, two other guys announced that they had a medication that would cure almost every kind of cancer. I mean, these things are developing rapidly there out of this place that was described by these guys. So the land has changed. The people are being regathered. They've had four wars. Hopefully outnumbered. I mean, overwhelmingly outnumbered. And you know, 67 and 73, that's, most people here remember those. Now you guys are too young. But, you know, the Six-Day War. If it hadn't stopped, they would have taken over Damascus and Cairo if the UN hadn't called a ceasefire. And 73, too. Military reports about how Arab commanders would look in their binoculars and think that they were totally outnumbered by Israeli forces, and there were actually 20 tanks and a few guys standing around. And they would retreat. So things are happening there, and I was telling Pastor Monica earlier, there's a feel there now that something's happening. Now, a lot of it, of course, is that there's always a state of tension because they're always worried about it being attacked. Now they got Iran to worry about because they're in Syria. So there's a certain amount of tension. But there's a spiritual tension, too. When you hear secular news people talking about Jesus, that's pretty wild. Secular news people here don't talk about Jesus. So the land's been restored, and it's the same land that God promised to Abraham.